You're listening to Episode 1 of Season 6 of The New World Order. Hi everyone, in this episode we're going to talk... Oh, first I should introduce everything. So hi everyone, my name is Klaatu, and this is The New World Order, formerly known as The Bad Apples. In this episode we're going to talk about the usual technology kind of topics. We're going to talk about sound, the nature of sound, and also a little bit about that Audacity, because I've been using Audacity a lot lately. But it won't be a how-to, it's really more of a technical analysis of like sound and the way that it works and the way that Audacity can work with it. We'll get into things like compressors and limiters and levelers and normalizers and equalizers and all kinds of cool stuff. And we'll take some listener feedback. And that's probably going to be it for this show. Oh, and a big special important announcement. So let's get started. Okay, so the subtleties of sound. Technically speaking, this is more of a Audacity tutorial, but I didn't want to think of it as an Audacity tutorial because there are lots of Audacity tutorials out there, and most of them, I think, tend to explain what I've always felt was actually one of the more intuitive applications known to man. I've seen people open up Audacity and just start editing sound without really ever having done that sort of thing before in their life. So I do think that it's a very intuitive interface, and I think the concept of editing together clips of sound is fairly intuitive. So the stuff that I'm going to go over is more like, well, the subtleties of digital audio as well as the subtleties of Audacity itself. And if this is a subject that interests you, of course, don't forget that there's the Open Source Musicians podcast, which goes over really a wide variety of digital audio production. So Audacity itself, the way I run it is with a custom config file that I have come up with and sort of come to rely on. It's something that's really, really turns Audacity, the interface, it pairs it way down to just the bare minimum, and it gives you a lot of keyboard shortcuts that consist of single key presses. Less things require, like control R or control whatever, you know, it's R, X, I, E, things like that. So you can kind of work with Audacity like you do with a lot of other pro applications, as they call it, where you would have like one hand on the mouse and one hand on the keyboard. Kind of like what you would do for Blender or GIMP, realistically. You should be doing it that way. My config file for Audacity follows that. You can get my config file from slackermedia.info, from the downloads page on that site. You can just download the config file and put it in, I think, .audacity-data is the folder, and just replace the old config with my config. Take a look in the edit preferences of Audacity once you relaunch it, and look at the keyboard pane, and that will give you all the new commands, or the new assignments for all the different commands that I use. So anyway, let's talk about audio. So digital audio is a digitized representation of an organic occurrence, right? So if you know what sound waves are, it's just air that has been that is now in movement. So there's these little waves happening through this medium of air, and when these ripples of movement hit your eardrum, it causes your eardrum to reverberate, and then the eardrum itself sends little signals to your brain or something, and you hear sound, and that's how that works. So digital audio is a computer taking a sound wave from reality and then redrawing it in digital form. So I don't know the technology of all that, but what you end up with is literally a representation of a wave. Now, in order for a computer to make that representation of a wave, it has to look at the wave, and then it has to draw, and then it has to look at the wave, and then draw, and then, you know, and eventually it has the wave's shape and sound and everything. So how many times it references that wave while that wave is occurring is called a sample rate. You will hear a couple of different sample rates being referenced, and one of them is the one that I'm recording at right now, which is 8,000 hertz, meaning that the little digitizer is taking a sample of sound waves of my voice 8,000 times a second. Another common one would be, for instance, 44,100 hertz, or 44.1 kilohertz. And that's the one that you, anytime you hear a CD, you heard 44 or 100. Nowadays, when you hear music that's been ripped from CDs, usually they just keep it at 44,100. Another common one was 48,000 or 48 kilohertz. Lots of different ones to choose from. 16 kilohertz, 22,050, and 32. Getting to know them is kind of a question of just listening to stuff at different sample rates to see what you're sacrificing when you knock something down a couple of sample rates. In Audacity, for instance, when you first open it up by default, if you've got it set up the default configuration or even the default configuration that I use, the project rate is set at 44,100. The project rate you can find on the lower left-hand side of the interface, and it says project rate in hertz, and there's a little drop-down menu, and right now it's probably set at 44,100. This is an important little box for Audacity because that's actually got a lot to do with what is going to end up getting exported out of Audacity. A lot of people don't realize that. The project rate can actually be really set to anything. Audacity is dynamic enough to be able to take all the different kinds of sample rate audio into its workspace and deal with it. And so I bring in my music and it's 44,100. I bring in my voice, it's 8,000 hertz. So I've got mixed sample rates in my project and it sounds great. But if I export at 44,100, then I'm exporting my project at really the highest, well, the most common high sample rate that there is. So before you export and you decide to yourself, well, I'm releasing a podcast, it's mainly just my voice, not that big of a deal, knock the project rate down from the default 44,100 down to, let's say, 22 kilohertz or 32 kilohertz and see if that sounds just as good for just the voice. So the project rate is really something that honestly should really be something that you see when you go to the export or export selection menu. You know, when you actually go to file, export to export your project, it really should be asking you, okay, at what rate would you like to export this? It doesn't. It's something that's set right there in the interface. It looks like it's something associated with your workspace. It's really kind of not. So keep that in mind in terms of file size, because obviously the lower your sample rate, the smaller your file size is going to be. The worst, you know, it'll create not as good audio, but it'll be a smaller file size. And depending on what your audio consists of, it may or may not really matter to you. Another thing that controls file size is whether you go mono or stereo in your project. And for me, for instance, at the beginning of the show, the beginning of the podcast's life, I was really proud of the music that was the intro and the outro, and I didn't want to sacrifice any quality. So I released in stereo 44,100, pretty big episodes compared to what I'm releasing now. But even today, I'm using the same source file. So I bring in my audio, and it says it's 44,100, and it's a stereo track. So even if I import mono tracks of my voice at 8,000 hertz, Audacity is still going to default to exporting a stereo end product because there is that stereo track present in your workspace. So understand that. If you have a stereo track in Audacity, it is going to export a stereo file. Whether you have mono files or not, whether you have mono tracks in the workspace or not, if there's one stereo track, it's going to be a stereo end product. So keep that in mind. If you want to end up with a mono file, like a mono AUG file or something to distribute, which again is going to be a lot less in file size, right? Because a mono track is one track and a stereo is two tracks. You go to track, well, you highlight the stereo track, and then you go to track and select stereo track to mono. And that will convert that one stereo track down to a mono track. For most things, this is fine. Stereo is really, really handy if you're trying to create space, you know, some kind of sense that you've got people actually in the room there with the listener, someone talking from the right, someone talking from the left, that sort of thing. That's really great for stereo. But again, if you're doing a podcast or something, do you really need that? For most music that was produced, you know, after, what, the 60s or so, stereo really is the only way to go. Because you figure they recorded it certainly with at least two microphones, and they probably mixed it with stereo in mind. So more often than not, if you're doing music production and stuff like that, well, if you're doing music production, you're probably not doing it in Audacity. But if you are, maybe you're just kind of doing a little bit of music post-production, then stereo would be a very good idea. But if it's just audiobooks and things like that, exporting as mono, you'll never notice. It'll place the sound dead center. So you put on two headphones, you'll hear the voice, you know, basically equally in each ear. If you take one out, you'll still hear that voice in that one ear. It's kind of nice for that reason. So mono is handy for the basic sound projects. Stereo is obviously really good for the more complex stuff. So that sort of brings me to the lowdown on tracks. tracks can be of about five different types in Audacity. So there's mono, which, like I say, that's one source of sound. That's one sound signal placed dead center in your sort of listening space. There's probably some technical term for that. But when you put on your earphones or you've got two speakers equidistant from yourself, you're going to hear that sound basically dead center, just like it was right in front of you. That's a mono track, and to get a new mono track, it would be track, add new, audio track. They don't call it mono for some reason in their menu system in Audacity. And that gives you one track for whatever audio you want to put into it. Recording, for instance, your voice in stereo with a single microphone is one of these bizarre things that a lot of people do, unless you've literally got it wouldn't be one microphone, it would be like two microphones. You know, you see some of the nicer digital recorders, they actually have two microphones on them, and those are basically two microphones pointing in exact opposite direction so that you now have the sense of the person moving around the microphone. That will give you a sense of space. That gives you the sense that each microphone is one of your ears, and so sometimes this person is very, very to your right or very, very to your left. And I would be mixing this to kind of show you what I mean, but I'm not doing this as a stereo episode, so it wouldn't do you any good. But, you know, you can kind of... The microphone in that case is basically your head. The microphones pointing in each different direction would be your ears. And wherever that person is in relation to that microphone is how it's going to end up sounding. They are in relation to your head. Those are stereo tracks. So really, those are two mono tracks getting the same, essentially the same signal, unless they're moving around the microphone, in which case one microphone is getting a little bit less of their voice while the other one is getting more. So these are stereo tracks. You can add a stereo track to Audacity by doing track, add new stereo track, or importing a stereo track. Remember that a stereo track, by nature, is going to give you a stereo product at the end of when you go to export your file from Audacity. Stereo is also essentially two mono tracks bound together. There's something different called joint stereo. Now, joint stereo is actually two mono tracks that simply you associate sort of more mentally as a stereo track. There's no actual connection between them. Joint stereo is kind of nice because you have a separate pan pot control for each one, completely independent of the other. Whether you actually need this all that much or not, it depends. So pan pot is whether something is left or right in this stereo space that is your head. So if I've got a joint stereo track and they both basically have my voice on these two mono tracks that we're calling joint stereo, then I can have my voice droning on and on in the dead center space of the stereo spectrum, and then I could, for some reason, move the other track more to the left or more to the right. I don't know why that would be something I would want to do, but we could do that sort of thing. You can actually make a stereo track joint stereo in Audacity. If you've got, for instance, if we go to track, you can try this if you're sitting in front of Audacity, track, add new stereo track. The track controls consist, that's the little panel on the left of every track. It consists of a little Xbox, not an Xbox, but a box with an X in it, and that kills the track and gets rid of it. So I'll undo that. Next to it, it's labeled. It says audio track, which, you know, is kind of a bad label because, yeah, it's an audio track, but Audacity also calls their mono track an audio track. So in this case, it really should be a stereo track, right? But that's what they call it, audio track. Well, that little button is actually a drop-down menu with lots of different options in it. You can name it. You can name the track. You can change the different view of it, whether it's the waveform or the waveform in decibels, spectrum, things like that. But you can also do something called split stereo track. That now creates a joint stereo track. And so you get all of your controls for each channel, for the right and the left track. So try that sometime. You'll see that you gain a whole other set of controls for each mono track that consists of a stereo group. So that's joint stereo. There's also something called a label track, which is, I think, fairly new. But it's, if you go to track, add new, label track, there's this, it looks like an audio track, except it's not. And if you double-click on it and start typing, you can actually label the space. You know, so if I say, okay, this is clat 2. Well, actually, realistically, we'd probably do, like, this is the intro. So now I've just labeled some space is the intro. And now I can grab onto the little handles, which looks like a big arrow. I can grab onto that and kind of define what space is the intro space. if I grab onto the outer handles, which are little circles, then I can move the label around within this track. So if you know you've got a segment of audio and you want to select it frequently, then if you label it, now if you have snapping turned on, you can select from that, just within that label, essentially. This is really handy for times where you might have a portion of the audio that is loop-friendly. It's something that you want to loop, something like that. Or it's something that you aren't really sure if it goes there or not, so you might want to move it around later. You can always label it and then come back, and it's really easy to select that exact same area again if you have it labeled. So that's a kind of a handy meta track, I guess. And there's also a time track. So track, add new time track gives you, at the very top of the project, an automated system whereby you can control the playback speed of the project. Okay, so if you've got your project rolling on at whatever speed it goes on at, then by using the envelope tool, which on my config file is just you hit E and you get the envelope tool. In the toolbar, it's the funky one that looks kind of like two triangles pointing up and down at each other. You can use the envelope tool to manipulate the line going through this time track, and you can actually control the speed of playback. So those are the different kinds of tracks. A couple of things to keep in mind. Like I say, first of all, if you have a stereo track in your project, then when you export, you are going to have a stereo file, no question about it. If you have all mono tracks, then you are going to have a mono file when you export. Simple as that. As far as I know, there's not really a way to change that. I could be wrong. It could be something in preferences that I just haven't bothered looking for, but that's as far as I know correct. Importing audio, which, you know, is just done file, import audio. Importing audio actually has a couple of different quirks. So my music that I use at the beginning and ending of the show is 44.1 kilohertz. So if I import that, then the project rate reads 44.100, the music is 44.100, everything's fine. And then I can import my voice at 8,000 hertz, and that kind of gets, I guess, sort of nested in there. Even though it's 8,000 hertz source material, it's in a 44.100 workspace. No problem. Audacity can deal with that. Now, here's the weird thing, though. If I go to File Import and I import my voice first, then the project rate defaults down to whatever, or up to whatever the file that I've just imported is. So if I import my voice at 8,000 hertz first, then the project rate becomes 8,000 hertz. So be aware of that. You might have imported something at one sample rate first, and then your project rate changes with that file. I've done that before. I've not noticed. I've exported and wondered why the quality was so bad. And the reason is because I accidentally imported my voice first, and that reset the project rate to 8,000 hertz. And then when you export, it's now exporting at 8,000 hertz. It almost feels like a bug, that method of doing things, but it's been like that for as long as I can remember. So it might just be the way that the Audacity people think it should happen. I'm not really sure. But just keep that in mind. Okay, so a couple of different things about the interface. So if you go to tracks and you add a new audio track, we have a mono track. Of course, you can resize tracks. I don't know if you know that. You can click on the bottom of the track space and just kind of drag it down, and that just literally increases your view. It doesn't modify the sound, of course. Let's look at the that left panel, because this is important stuff. So the first panel there is a little box with an X in it. That kills the track, gets rid of it. The next one was the selection for different things. So you can name the audio track, which is a great idea. If you're working on a project, you might as well take the extra time to name the tracks, unless it's just something that you're going to get done and get out really fast. But if it's something that's real, you might want to name your tracks so that you know what they are. You can move the tracks up and down, although you can do that with clicking and dragging as well. And then you can actually set the way that you see these waveforms, these sound waves. This is important, and again, the default configuration, I think, is really not very useful. The default configuration has it set, honestly, I don't actually know the term for it, but they call it waveform, but it measures absolute zero at absolute silence at zero and absolute maximum sound at one. I don't know who uses that system. Maybe that's like a booming industry somewhere where people do measure sound that way, but the way that I've always been taught and the way that I think of sound and the people that I know are the same way are in decibels. So if you go to the little drop-down menu there and go down to where it says waveform, waveform decibels, spectrum, spectrum log, and pitch, choose waveform decibels. And this is actually the default in my configuration where I went into edit preferences and said, okay, default to the decibel view. Decibel view measures this completely linear in decibels, zero being the maximum sound level that the speaker is going to be able to, not the speaker like person, but like the audio output device is going to be able to handle without introducing distortion. I don't really know enough about decibels to know why that's the case. I don't know why zero is the maximum and everything that we're really talking about is negative, but that's just how it is, and it's always been like that, so it's not a big deal. If you make your track a lot larger, you need to make it practically the full size of the screen probably to really get all the levels of decibels that I want to talk about. But if you do that, you'll see that about midway, that it's negative 36. And that's because around negative 36 and lower, it starts to get really hard to hear audio. So if you've got stuff that's below negative 36 decibels, most people and most programs are going to consider it noise. Now, we talk about noise very liberally in real life. We talk to each other and we say, why are you making so much noise? Or what's all that noise? In audio, it's different. We say noise is stuff that is unwanted, something that we do not want to hear, and a sound, you know, an actual sound that we like, that we are trying to emphasize or show the audience, set out there for the audience to hear, is signal. So you've got signal and noise. You've got your noise floor at like negative 36-ish, hopefully, and then everything above that ideally would be signal. The thing about signals is that they tend to be very variable in nature, right? I mean, my voice it's not a constant level of sound, correct? I mean, even a word is not a constant level of sound. A typical word is going to start one way and then it's going to finish another way. And then introduce into that just the variation of how we speak, where we emphasize certain words, we trail off sometimes, things like that. That's just the nature of what a sound signal is going to be like. So it's hard to say, oh, I want all my sound to be at a certain level, and that way no one will ever have to adjust their volume switch. And that is the ultimate goal when you're mixing audio. You basically want the audience to be able to sit down, set the remote control aside, and just listen, and not have to sit there and fiddle with their media player all the time to increase the volume to hear something, or then decrease it because something got too loud. That would be really, really annoying. And if you've ever heard someone who doesn't know how to mix really at all, you might notice that about their audio. That you know, even in a podcast, they'll be talking, and for some reason, the first segment that they did was really, really soft. And then suddenly the next segment that they do is really, really loud. That's simply because they're not monitoring their levels, possibly because they don't know how to. But, I mean, it doesn't matter why, but that's what's going on, is that their levels are not set consistently across their project. So if you think about what that would mean, well, in TV and film, for instance, it means something very specific. And it means that the average sound, like the sound of the average human voice, when the people are just talking to each other kind of normally, those are set at negative 12 decibels or negative 15 decibels. It depends on whether you're talking about TV or movies. The negative for podcasting, I would kind of favor what TV favors, which is negative 12 decibels, because really, if you think about it, the range of dynamic sound effects and things in a podcast is usually not that great. That is, that your average voice could be at negative 12, and you can pretty much count that there's not going to be that much more in your sound that's going to be louder than that voice. I mean, the voice is what we're all about. On TV, it typically is the same way. They really want you to hear the voices because TV is very story-driven. A lot of people do a lot of other things while they're watching TV. You know, we often multitask a lot when we're watching television shows, so it's really helpful and kind of expected from the American audience, at least. I don't know much about other markets, but the American audience expects to be able to turn on the TV and then do other stuff, but still understand what just happened in the latest episode of their favorite series. So if they get up and go and make a sandwich, they want to be able to still be listening to that TV show and get the voices and understand what's going on. So for that reason, they mix the voices usually around negative 12 decibels, and the explosions and the gunfire and all the loud dramatic music might reach, oh, I don't know, negative 6, negative 4 decibels, and they don't have to rush into the room and turn down the volume really quick. It's all kind of a safe, kind of happy average sound range. The negative 15 decibels gives you a little bit more of a ceiling, right? So if you're mixing for a movie where the audience is sitting in the theater, their eyes are glued to the screen anyway, plus you want to rock them and shake them and make them jump, well, it's great to have a little bit more of a ceiling there, because now you can put all your normal voices at negative 15 decibels, and then your explosions can go all the way up to, you know, like negative 2 decibels, which is what, like 10, 12, 13, like something like 13 decibels, you know, away from the negative 15, which, I mean, that's a lot louder than negative 15 decibels. Negative 2 decibels is exponentially louder, literally, than negative 15 decibels. So it just kind of depends on what your audience is and what you expect them to tolerate for the whole volume adjustment thing. Honestly, for my show, for the podcast, I generally try to mix it more like around negative 6 decibels, because I figure there's really no variation in sound. It's just me droning on and on and on, on and on and on, on and on and on, on and on and on. And so that should be fairly loud. You should be able to set the volume in your car as you commute to work or whatever, or as you're walking the dog or just doing whatever around the house. You can set the volume at a level comfortable for your ears, and I'm going to be talking, and you're going to hear my voice, and then I might play some music, but it's never going to get really any louder than my voice. You're not going to have to reach over and turn it down really quick. I don't have exciting special effects or anything like that, so there's no explosions or gunshots or spaceships zooming by. So you have to kind of know your market and know what you expect them to do with your content, but either way, your goal should be to make the VU meter. The VU meter, at least on my configuration, is on the bottom right-hand side. It's the little level thing that jumps up and down while the voices are playing. That's called a VU meter. So you want to make sure that on average, when you're playing through the whole project, that VU meter just kind of hovers around whatever level you've decided is going to be your average sound level. It's never going to stay exactly at negative 6 unless we generate a tone and say, make the amplitude of this tone exactly negative 6 decibels. If we do that, then yes, it will be exactly negative 6 decibels without any kind of variation. Otherwise, you're not going to get a constant level, but you should always be thinking about that sort of average sound level and assume that, yeah, people might miss the end of a sentence, but they'll probably fill it in with contextually, or yeah, people might think that music comes in a little bit loud, but it's within that acceptable range. It's not going to be something that throws them out of whatever they're doing and make them fiddle around with their volume switch every other minute. And before I continue, we should probably go ahead and take a coffee break, because I'm not showing any sign of slowing down here. So let's go grab a coffee, and then we'll come back and continue this exciting discussion.
Space coffee. The choice of United Planetary Space Cadets all over the galaxy.
Okay, so that's setting your levels, honestly. Now, there's a lot more that goes into that, which, actually, I guess, you know what, maybe I could go ahead and go into that. I was going to save it for a little bit later. So the different ways to adjust your levels, well, there's a couple of different ways. So there's the envelope tool itself in a track. So if you've got a sound wave in a track, I'm going to make this track a lot smaller right now. I've got it stretched out really, really big so I can see all the little decibel markings. But if you've got a sound wave, you can actually just make it, I mean, however loud it looks, I mean, it should be a nice strong signal, ideally. If it's too strong, it might be jumping up way too loud. So you can use your envelope tool to actually click and make little nodes in this little blue range of audio. And then you can pull those nodes down, and as you pull them down, the voice gets softer and softer, even if the person isn't actually speaking any softer, which you just got a demonstration of. So that adjusts the level of audio on that track independently of any other track, which is nice. And it also, of course, ensures that it's not destructive. It's not actually modifying the sound wave. The more of that sort of thing you can do, probably the better in terms of giving yourself flexibility, because, I mean, think about it. Maybe for one moment I just think, well, I'm obviously going to fade out there. There's no question about that. So I go in and do some kind of fade out with an effect, which literally changes the audio sort of irreversibly. I mean, you can undo, but after a while you couldn't. So if I did an effect where I faded out and then I kept working and working and working, maybe I saved, I closed, I went I went away, and then I came back, reopened it. Okay, so now my levels of undo are gone. So now I suddenly decide that instead of fading out there, I wanted it actually to keep going. Well, guess what? I've just changed the audio. There's no way to do that except to re-import the source file, which, again, that might be something that's, you know, if your project is really basic, that might be something that you can do. But once you start getting a lot of tracks in there, start cutting up audio, it could get really hard to match that audio exactly the same. So the envelope tool is a nice non-destructive way of modifying sound. The other way to do it would be the effect menu, effect amplify. Amplify is funny because it goes either way. In Audacity, you can amplify it up or you can amplify it down. Basically, it's just a gain level, as far as I know. I mean, you're selecting a portion of audio or a whole track or whatever, and you say amplify, and you tell it to increase the signal and the noise by X number of decibels. And that's that, and it does it. The advantage of that is that you now have a new level of audio that you can then adjust with your envelope tool. There have literally been times when the audio is so loud in the track that it really just doesn't even fit in the track. Now, Audacity has floating points, so you can actually have stuff that doesn't quite fit in your track, and you can actually see the tips of some of those audio waves. If you grab the envelope tool and just move the whole envelope down, you can sometimes see tips of audio waves kind of peeking out the other end. That's all going to get distorted in the end, though. So, I mean, amplifying that down sometimes helps, because otherwise it's just you're going to have to sit there with the envelope tool every time you use that audio and reduce it. So it's kind of handy that way. Another sort of the other way, sometimes the audio is so quiet that the envelope tool won't do you any good because you can't increase the envelope any more than 100%. So you need to select the audio that is so quiet and amplify it, and then you've got louder signal and louder noise. That's an important distinction. So that's the amplify tool. There's also a little, there's a temporary or a variable amplifying tool. There's a little slider on the controls of the track, and on one end it says minus, and one end it says positive, and you guessed it. If you slide it one way or the other, it either adds or decreases gain. So gain, like I said about amplify, I mean, gain is very indiscriminate. All it does is boost the sound or knock the sound down a couple of decibels. And when I say sound, I mean sound. I mean the noise level, like the hiss of the room around you, the sound of the server under your desk, whatever, the kids in the background, you know, all that stuff gets amplified along with your voice. So it's very indiscriminate. It's going to do noise and signal, and that's that. So if we're happy with the sound level, since the sound is very variable, you will find that sometimes the sound might hit that dreaded 0 decibel mark, and your VU meter goes red. And that's telling you that, hey, I have hit 0 decibels, and if you export me as is, chances are the speaker is going to rattle a little bit, or the headphone's going to rattle a little bit. And that's a bad thing. You don't really want to do that. In theory, you can do it here and there without really causing serious problems. Consistently in red would probably be a real problem. I tend to be very conservative, and I try not to hit red at all before I export. If I'm hitting red before I export, I knock it down just that extra tiny bit. Realistically, it might not matter. It's probably not that big of a deal, but I am a little bit conservative that way. There are a couple of different ways to make sure that you're not hitting red. The reason things are hitting red, obviously, is because they're too loud. Now, if you're hitting consistent red marks in your VU meter, meaning that your sound is just jumping up to zero all the time, then probably the overall sound file that you've got, that region of sound in Audacity, is simply too loud, and you need to reduce it with the envelope tool or the amplify tool and just knock it down like a decibel. The problem here is that sometimes something is so full of variation in sound level that if you do that, then yeah, the loud parts aren't hitting zero anymore, but you can barely hear the quiet parts, and you still obviously want to hear the quiet part. So this is a symptom of the range of audio of being too great, right? There's extreme quiet and there's extreme loud, and there's not really that middle ground. You want to get things more toward the middle ground. Well, there's a tool for that. And this is where Audacity, I want to say fails, but it doesn't necessarily fail. But this is one of those times, one of the many times in Audacity, that you need to really, if you're getting to this level of technicality, you almost have to question why you're doing it in Audacity and you're not doing it in something like Ardour or QTractor. And here's why. We're going to use a tool, in this case called Compressor, and it's going to change the sound, and it's going to help us in that sense. It's going to compress the dynamic range for us, i.e. it's going to take the really, really soft parts and raise them up a little bit, and it's going to take the really, really loud parts and knock them down a little bit, thereby decreasing the range of levels between those different parts. So that's nice, that's good. But in Audacity, that change is applied instantly. So if you think about, I don't know, something in GIMP where you've made a change to a layer and then you decide to flatten the project such that it's one layer now, it's no longer a multi-layer. That's kind of what Audacity is doing when you do an effect like this. It takes the audio in Audacity and it takes that effect, it puts them together, it calculates what the audio would look like after that effect, and then it writes the affected audio back out into your track. Meaning that now if we save it and we close it, we go have a cup of coffee and we come back and open it back up, and we decide, wow, I really overdid that compression. It sounds horrible. I better undo that. Sorry, pal. It wrote that compressed. It wrote it out as a compressed audio file in Audacity, and the only way to undo it at this point would be to re-import the source file. So that's a big disadvantage in the sense of being flexible later on. That's where Ardour or QTractor or something like that are going to excel, where Audacity simply doesn't do that. The place that Audacity kind of excels, where they fail in that sense, is that doing it this way in Audacity drastically reduces your concerns over things like real-time effects and even CPU usage. Because if you're asking Ardour to play back an audio file, and while it's playing this source file, to apply compression to it, well, that's a big demand on your CPU. It's also demanding on the kernel. And if you don't have the real-time patches applied to the kernel, which, by the way, you can learn to do on your own at slackermedia.info, if you don't have those applied, then it's not going to play back smoothly for you, probably. So it's a good thing in the sense that if you've got a low-powered system, like I do, it makes things really a lot faster, you know, because it uses your CPU once, uses it to calculate what's going to happen to your audio, and then it uses it to write that back out to the track, and then it's done. Your CPU is freed again. But if you want to be able to come back and tweak settings later on, it's probably not the best place to be doing it. So anyway, if you go to Effect, well, if you select the area of audio that you want to affect first, and in order to select things, you have to have your selector tool, which is, on my config, the I key on the tool bar that my config doesn't even have, but the default config of Audacity will have it. It's a little I-beam, you know, that little symbol that you get in a word processor. I should say in a GUI word processor. So you have that. You select the area of the audio. You go to Effect, and then go to Compressor. This is a dynamic range compressor, and there are a couple of different things that a dynamic range compressor deals with pretty much in any, I mean, it's really, it's just, if it's a dynamic range compressor, these are some of the terms that you're going to want to get to know. So there's the threshold. That's the first slider. That defines what I think of as kind of the zone. And this zone is this place where any sound wave that encroaches into this little zone that we've defined will be considered an extremist, and it will be knocked down. Those are the terms that the GNU World Order uses, you know, the violent, revolutionary kinds of words. So anytime that the noise level reaches that zone, then the compressor pushes it back out of the zone. It says, no, you're not going to get in here, you're too loud, stay down there with all the other sound. You can see, obviously, how this is reducing the dynamic range of your sound, right? Because it's saying anything that gets way, way up here, we're going to apply compression to. How much compression is applied to it? Well, that's actually dictated by the third slider down, called the ratio. That literally says for every decibel that the sound wave trespasses into our little zone, how much compression are we going to push back? The default, I think, is usually 2:1, meaning for every decibel that it comes into, it's going to be pushed down by 2 decibels. That's kind of that's a pretty safe place to be. You can certainly do more. You can do a 4:1. Three to one. Those are the kind of the common ones. They tend to be used for different purposes. For voices, you'll hear 2:1 being done fairly frequently. For something like a drum hit, you know, if you're doing music and there's a snare hit, and that can get loud. So that's not going to just encroach on our little zone like 1 decibel. That's going to get right up in that zone. So we need to knock it down quite heavily. And you'll find that if you start going crazy with a compressor, you'll start almost hearing the compression being applied, which doesn't make a whole lot of sense until you understand the concept of the attack and the release time. So the attack is how quickly the compressor starts applying itself to the sound wave. So if you've got a very, very fast attack, like 0.1 second, then the minute the sound wave approaches, it gets into the zone, it's just being blocked out. It's like a force field, and it's a very sudden kind of quick thing. That's sometimes not a very graceful way of doing it. Sometimes that's the desired effect, however, especially with drums. You'll hear, on drum tracks, you'll hear people doing that because they want to kind of add like this sort of... So the noise floor is anything that's a level, and anything below that is considered noise. So it's just literally ignored. It's just nothing happens to noise. That could be a very good thing. If you've got a lot of noise in the background and you look at your audio and you kind of figure, okay, the noise is basically all happening. You know, my signal is pretty healthy above, let's say, negative 24 decibels, but there's a lot of noise below that. You could set your noise floor up to like negative 30 decibels or negative 26 decibels and see what happens there. You might be able to bring up the signal that's just above the noise and leave the noise behind. And everything in audio and video really is all about contrast, right? There might be noise there, but if your ear is really concentrating on this voice that has this nice strong signal, then the noise becomes negligible. And especially when decibels are concerned, I mean, if the noise is sitting down at like negative 30 decibels, that's pretty quiet anyway. So if you've got everything else that actually matters way up at like negative 18, negative 15, negative 12 decibels, you're probably doing okay. The problem becomes when the noise starts encroaching in the same decibel range that your signal is living in. That becomes a lot more difficult. So that's compressor. That helps you just kind of even out the sounds because the sounds will start to get, they start to go all over the place, get really soft, get really loud, and that might play havoc on you trying to find a nice average sound level to mix your project at. Another tool that you might want to look at is a limiter. Now, actually, let's not talk about limiter first. Let's talk about leveler first. Leveler is a pretty easy little plugin in Audacity, and again, you just select the area that you want to select, and it's really just sort of different options, basically presets for a compressor. But it's a drop-down menu, and it's got it starts out with none, which is weird because why are you opening this at all? But it starts out with none, and then it's light, moderate, heavy, heavier, and heaviest. And depending on what the sound is, you can try different degrees of leveling. You can also set your noise floor, or your noise threshold, rather. So you can set that to, like, I don't know, depending on where your noise is, but negative 40, negative 35, negative 30, whatever. And then you can preview it, or you can say okay and see what happens. But what will happen is that it will take audio that's getting really, really loud and just kind of knock it down to a more average place. You know, if you're finding that people are talking and some people are going really quiet, or some parts are getting quiet and some parts are really loud, you can even that out a little bit by using the leveler. The problem with this is that sometimes it does very, very drastic things and it sounds completely unnatural, so it doesn't always work for you, but it may work, just depending on the sound. It's definitely something to look at. There's also a limiter, which is going to be installed only if you've got Audacity as well as your LADSPA effects. So first of all, I mean, I don't know a whole lot about default compiling of Audacity. I don't know how Ubuntu does it. I don't know how Fedora does it. The Audacity that I use is a very specific version that I've latched onto. Lately, it's been 1.3.12, and I custom compile it on Flackware, and that's how I use Audacity, and it's just kind of how I have to use it, because that's what really works for me, and Audacity is a tool that I use often. So I know that when I configure it, there's an option to enable LADSPA, and if you have LADSPA installed, then Audacity will be able to see LADSPA, and in your effects, you'll get a whole group of submenus called plugins, very unfriendly named 1 to 15, 16 to 30, 31 to 45, and so on. But within those menus are all these different LADSPA effects, the most popular being, of course, the Steve Harris plugins. And the Steve Harris plugins are, from what I understand, plugins either designed or ported to LADSPA by a guy named Steve Harris, and that's that. So one of his effects, which I find in my menu plugins 46 to 60, is called the Hard Limiter, which looks like it's by Marcus Anderson, and it's a GPL plugin, and it's got three different settings. And there's the dB limit, there's the wet level, and the residue level. The dB limit is simply going to look at sound that gets very loud, and it's going to say, what decibel level shall I limit it to? This is obviously really, really good for places where you've got a great audio level. It's just trucking along at negative 12 or negative 6, whatever you're happy with. And then there's just little moments where it peaks up into zero or above. So the dB limit for that, you might want to say, well, let's knock those sounds down to like negative 2 decibels, and that'll bring it more within our range. The wet level you want to set at 1, but then the residue level tells you how harshly that sound wave will be limited. The name of the plugin is Hard Limiter, so be very aware of that. With your residue level set at 0, it's going to be almost just clipped off. It is the sound wave just kind of almost gets cut off practically. It's a very hard limit. It just pushes the sound wave down 2 decibels, doesn't worry about rounding off the sound wave or anything like that. It's a very harsh kind of thing. I was using this in some music that I was mixing, and I was noticing that was working really, really great for my drums, and it just wasn't really working for the other stuff, and that I thought I was hearing distortion, and sure enough, I was. And I went into Open Source Musician channel on Freenode, and a couple of people there helped me figure out with some really great ideas on troubleshooting. They had some great ideas on how to diagnose this problem and see what was really going on. And one of them even cracked open the source code, which apparently he just had on hand because he just looked at it right then and there. It was really bizarre, but it is true that the residue level will kind of distort. It will maintain any kind of distortion that would have been occurred in that sound wave if it had reached, you know, if it had actually gone above 0 decibels. You can, I guess, you're increasing the resolution, if you will, of that sound wave by increasing the residue level. But what you get in the end is you get less limiting. So kind of weird. So if there's something that's really, really way into the extreme past 0 decibels, and you set it at a high residue level and at a dB limit that's only like negative 2, you still might have a sound wave reaching above 0 decibels. So it's this kind of thing that you kind of have to play around with to get down where you want it without any distortion. But it's definitely a good tool, and it only affects the stuff that goes into the 0 decibels. So it's not a dynamic range compressor as such. It really is just a limiter. It says, here's my zone, and if you're in my zone, I'm going to knock you down. So it's handy for that, but it can be a little bit hard sometimes, but it is kind of nice if all you love everything else, you just don't like the fact that these things are peaking and distorting. You can knock those down with the Hard Limiter. We shouldn't forget the Normalize tool as well, which I guess there is one in Audacity. I never use that one. I always do my normalizing before I get into Audacity. It's a little line command tool called Normalize, or if you're on Debian, probably most Debian-based distributions, it would be Normalize-Audio. There was a really great article on this tool in Linux Format a couple of months ago, and the strength of Normalize is actually twofold. One, it's great for mastering 5 or 12 different songs. Now normalize them in relation to each other, and it will calculate the average sound level of each file and then adjust them accordingly so that when you listen to them, the average sound range, or the average sound level, is pretty much the same across each song. So it's a great tool. But you can also do that for an audio file itself. Just say, hey, look at this audio file, only consider this one audio file, and here is an average decibel level that I will tell you. And you can set that average level for something. For my podcasts, I actually set it pretty drastically, something that I wouldn't normally recommend. It's negative 4 decibels average. That's insane. More realistically, you're going to be setting things at like negative 12 decibels, and that will get your audio level at that magic sort of friendly negative 12 point, and then you can import it into Audacity and edit and mix and stuff like that from there. Normalize is a destructive tool, so before you use it, you need to actually make sure that you've made a copy of your source file, because when you say normalize input file -a negative 12 decibels, it normalizes that file forever. So do not use Normalize without making a copy of your source first. And last but not least, there's equalization. Equalizers, you've probably maybe even played around with equalizers, like on your media player. A lot of those have like a little software-based equalizer, and you can choose, oh, I'm listening to rock music, so I'll choose the rock EQ setting. I'm listening to classical now, I'll use the classical EQ setting. And equalizing actually is a really great tool because you've got this source file, and it's just like, I don't know if you've ever used like GIMP or Digicam or some graphic tool, and you have like levels, right, or curves, or brightness and contrast. Once again, all this stuff is always about like contrast and ratios and how one thing is in relation to another. So if you take a photograph, it looks fantastic. You're thinking to yourself, there's no way this could get any better. You throw it into GIMP, and then you open up the levels or the curves, and you start messing around, and you start bringing up the highlights and bringing down the shadows and just increasing sort of the contrast between those layers, those different ranges. And you say, okay. And then you do an undo, and you look at the way that it looked before, and now you look at it after. It always looks so much better. I mean, unless you've overdone it. But it's like you're wiping this layer of grime away from the photograph. In post-production, whether it's video, graphic, or audio, the job of the artist is to give us something that is more pleasing to perceive. And one of those things in audio, usually, is the feeling that there are bass parts and treble parts. We want some kind of distinction between all that. We don't want it to all be muddled in together. That's where EQ comes in. So if you go to Effect Equalization, then you get a nice little equalizer that you can, and this has come a long way in Audacity, but you can. There are some presets. Those presets are really strange choices to me, but I've got some presets that I use. Again, you have to select the audio first, I should have said. So then you go to Effects and then Equalization. And this is, I guess, by Martin Shaw and Mitch Golden. You've got little controls, and I think it's probably a 30-band equalizer. I didn't count lately. But yeah, you've got nice controls. What do these controls do? Well, they control the different frequencies of the sound that is going to be boosted or brought down. Less is more here, usually. Very rarely will you find yourself moving these little sliders drastically. It's really something that, just like in GIMP, I mean, you know, adjusting the levels a whole lot, it just almost makes a cartoon image, right? It just makes things so extreme that it doesn't even look real. It just looks like bad digital images. So the same goes for EQ. More often than not, and like I say, this is, you know, I'm giving you what I have found to be frequently true and what I was taught was frequently true. I'm not saying these are absolute hard and fast rules, but the part that usually we're hearing a lot and that we like to hear is this golden range of where the human voice happens to hang out, which is generally speaking around, on this equalizer, it'd be like 400 hertz to 1000 hertz. There's an actual range of that. I want to say it starts at 500 and goes up to 800 or something like that, 500 to 1000-ish. So boosting that sometimes is a really, really good thing, because a lot of times either the voice that you're hearing or the instrument that is being played that is really sort of like the main instrument, like which in rock, of course, is going to be like a guitar, right? A lot of times that'll be in that same area. Sometimes you can't know, and you just have to sit there and fiddle around with the EQ and try to find that sound. Do that would be to do those drastic movements, you know, boost up 500 hertz and 600 hertz and 700 hertz, boost it up way up, and see if that changes that guitar sound or that voice sound or whatever sound you're trying to boost. If it does, then you found the range. Rarely, if ever, is any sound just one slider. It's going to be, you know, the slider that really, really affected it, and then it's going to be the one next to it on either side, maybe the two next to it on either side. And again, I don't know if I've said it yet or not, less is more, really. You can sit there and push these things up and pull them down and think that you've got great audio, you'll save it, you'll quit, you'll go away, you'll have coffee, you'll come back, and you'll realize that things sound comical. So less is more. And yeah, that's pretty much it. That's the idea. So you find the ranges that you want to boost. One range that I do sometimes boost. So the 20 hertz to 40 to 60, all the way up to, I guess, 100 hertz, more or less, is kind of the bass range. That's the really low sounds. I actually sometimes raise those up a little bit, depending on the sound file. If it's really heavy on the bass already, I might not need to boost those. I might even need to knock it down a little bit. But that's where you would look for, like, bass guitar or those low drones of synthesizers and things like that. And then, of course, obviously, the higher stuff, like the 5,000 hertz and above, are those, well, higher sounds, like the flutes and high synthesizers and things like that. Now, they also sometimes are things like tape hiss or things like that, like noise. Sometimes you'll find high-pitched noise in that range. So if it's a question of you going in to lessen the noise, you're not going to knock it out. It's not on a separate track. It's not like you're just going to hit the mute button and that's going to be gone. But you can sometimes minimize the amount of noise by finding the frequencies where those noises live and just kind of minimize those with the equalizer. And then you say okay and it processes it. And again, because it's Audacity, it's going to write that right back out to your track. So it's not really something that you can go back and tweak later on after you've kind of decided, yeah, that's pretty good. And again, that's another disadvantage of Audacity as well as an advantage of Audacity. And you know what? I think that's about it. I think that's all I've got about Audacity and about sound, and I hope that was informative. It wasn't really pointed toward a goal, of course, because there's so much that you can do with Audacity. You could be doing podcasting, you could be doing music stuff, you could be doing editing sound from any source, really. So, you know, transferring records to digital, all the things that people do with Audacity. Those are just some of the tools that you can use and some of the sort of things to be aware of. Yeah, so I do hope that helped. Knock yourself out. If you have any questions, email me. First of all, I want to thank everyone who emailed me with, support for the new name and everything. I have to admit, I was a little bit nervous about doing the whole name change because I thought, well, it could be, it could be a bad thing. People might not like it. It might sound really weird and extremist or something. So it might be off-putting, you know, whatever. But getting a lot of people emailing in and saying, hey, great new name, you know, it fits your show better or whatever, was much appreciated. So thanks to everyone who emailed me about that. So that knocked out like half the email right there. More listener feedback from Bazawil, who used to be a Linux Cranks regular, sort of. I mean, he seemed to always be around the Cranks, but that was when the Cranks were cool. But yeah, so Bazawil says that he was encoding some video or something like that, and it was actually not a video, it's a song, but there's like a still image over it. You know, you've seen that on like YouTube where they'll put like a still image and then the song. So he was asking if the video encoder is encoding that picture, you know, every single frame of as long as that song goes on, or if the encoder is smart enough to just encode the picture once and then just kind of make it persist. The answer is, on every encoder I've ever dealt with, it's smart enough to simply encode the picture once, and then it simply doesn't change the pixels. It just says, okay, those are the pixels as they were, and they don't change, and that's that. And that's obviously a great thing. And that's actually how video encoders kind of like cut down the size of videos. That's one of the ways. They simply say, they look at every single pixel, and they say, okay, well, has this pixel changed since the last frame? No, it has not. Okay, well, we won't re-encode that then, and we can just reuse that pixel now in this new frame. And then if it has changed, then they re-encode it. Now, how much change consists of a change in a video encoder's mind? Well, that's a setting that you typically can set. You can say that you want, every change to the slightest shade, you know, just if it changes hue in the slightest, then re-encode. Or you can say, not a big deal, you know, if it's more or less still red from one frame to another, just keep it. You can also say how many pixels is seen as a pixel. You can tell the encoder, yes, that's a pixel, but just to save yourself work, to save us file size, consider this group of pixels sort of the same. And if that group changes, then re-encode. And if it doesn't, then just assume everything's still the same. And if you do that really drastically, you start to get that sort of blocky digital look. But that's the theory behind it anyway. So thanks for that question, Bazawil. A question that a lot of people have asked me really ever since the show began. Since the show really kicked in, which was after I started doing Linux Reality episodes. So people have been asking me for a while, where can they find the music at the beginning and the ending of the show? And up until now, I haven't really had a very good answer at all, because it wasn't available. Through a number of different events, one being that my show no longer releases in full quality stereo sound, right? So the music obviously is suffering greatly, and that was really the main reason why I wanted to do a high sample rate 44-100 stereo AUG file, because I really liked the music. But I've since figured, well, you've got the music clips from all the old seasons, so now I'm just going to cut the show down to a lower sample rate and just do a mono release, and it's a lot smaller of a download file, so I think most people probably appreciate it. I know I certainly do. But the end result is that you don't get the nice, pretty music all the time. So this, as well as sort of the some motivation placed upon me from the artists themselves, or rather the artists' management, since as we all know, the bands themselves were lost in a tragic accident in the Bermuda Triangle. But there's been motivation now to get the music at the beginning and the end of my show out into your hands, so that you can actually, stop emailing me and asking me where you can find it, right? I mean, plus it's good music. I really like it. So anyway, me and a couple of other people have been working really hard on getting the original source material for all this music, and actually doing post-production on it, bringing it into Slacker Media. Actually, it's been a completely free software workflow. No Cubase used anywhere, for instance. And so, yeah, we've got all the source material, and I've been mixing it for the past couple of months. We've hired some actors to come in, do some parts. We've scoured the web for the best Creative Commons content. Some of it, I think, was probably gotten from the multimedia sprint, but a lot of this has been just stuff from freesound.org and other places. And so the result has been really a really cool free software and Creative Commons joint effort. And so far it's resulted in 4 completely mixed albums with more to come. So the first 2 are going to be released on our very own, very fine Linux AUG-only shows, Juiced Penguin, which is, of course, Randy Noseworthy's and Terry F's show, and Cerebral Mix, which is Sound Chaser's show. And I'll have links to both of those sites in the show notes. But on the 26th of September, which probably is in like 4 days when you hear this, they're going to play one each, a different album of the band Fat Chance Lester. That's the band who did the music for the show. And it's really cool stuff. So the one album is called Napalm Lounge, and that is, in the PR person's words, Mad Max meets Ricky Ricardo. So it's sort of a bizarre kind of space rocky kind of thing, and that one contains the closing titles and the opening titles of this show, in that order, actually. The closing titles that I used for the show actually happened at the beginning of the album, and the opening happens at the end. And it wasn't because we structured it that way, it was just how the band played it. That's actually just one track. It's a 1 hour long track. So if you like space trippy rock, that's your first stop, Napalm Lounge. The post-production was done by me. The actual mixing was done by a guy named George in New York at the Sound Shop, yeah. So I don't take credit for the music mix, although I did do some equalization on it and stuff, but I do take full credit for all of the post-production, which in some cases was really, really drastic stuff. Sometimes it was just cutting out parts that didn't come out quite as well as I think the band wanted them to, but some places it was resampling the band and reusing their own sounds to create new sounds, just weird stuff like that. It was adding in sound effects and all kinds of cool stuff. So check that out. If you are more into spacey, trippy rock that isn't an hour long, then you can listen to the fantastic alternate universes of Fat Chance Lester, which have 4 tracks on it. And it's a 10-minute track, a 19-minute track, a 10-minute track, and another 10-minute track. It has, I think, a much more postmodern sound. It's a little bit more of a mashup, I guess. You'll hear, I guess, elements from modern music in it, or modern music production in it, but it's still the sort of same classic progressive rock sounds of Fat Chance Lester. So it's kind of it's an interesting one. You should check it out. And the cool thing about the Napalm Lounge album, the first one that the Juiced Penguin will be playing, I think, I could be wrong about who's playing what and when, but I think it's the 26th anyway. Actually, Sigflup did the album art for that one. She didn't do it for the music. I mean, she had done the album art for herself, but I saw it online and I asked her to use it, if I could use it. And she said yes, and it's this perfect picture. It's like this person holding up an alien mask over their face, and it's really mysterious looking, and considering how spacey and trippy this music is, it's kind of perfect. So it's a really cool album art. There's going to be a site up at some point where you can just download these songs. And yes, they'll actually be available in more than just Ogg. I know it's amazing. But like I say, I'm not the only person involved here. It's not like I can just release an Ogg and walk away from it. So there will be a site somewhere that contains the Ogg file, the AAC file, and the FLAC file. So you can get it in whatever format you want, basically. I mean, if AAC doesn't play on your media player, you're probably not using a modern media player. If Ogg doesn't play on your media player, you're not using a cool media player. And then if you have some other format that you want to go out to, just grab the FLAC file. It's big, but you can grab that and do that. And the downloads that will be available online, not just me involved, but there'll be like a PDF liner notes, which I actually created, but you know, it's got information in there about the other artists and stuff like that, and all the attribution credit for the Creative Commons content and stuff like that. So look out for that site when it appears. I assume it'll be out on the 26th or the 27th, but I'm not exactly sure when all that's happening. But rest assured that it was an entirely free software production, which is really, really cool. It's less cool because the recording itself, I don't think, was done to software. It was a hardware-based recording, so it's not like the band had this big Linux setup that we all dream of. It was just a hardware-based recording, I think. And then it went into, then it got mixed down, and then it got delivered to me. That's the workflow. But all the post-production and all the creation of all this release material, the PDF, booklet, the liner notes, the FLAC, the AAC, the Ogg versions, all that, Slacker Media all the way. So we can be proud of that part, at least. So, that's the big announcement. So go listen to the music and enjoy. And you can let me know how you like it, but also feel free to contact the band or the band management or whoever is behind this and let them know as well. And I don't know their contact information, public contact information, so I assume it will be on the site. So anyway, enjoy. And I think that's it for this episode. So thank you for listening. My name is Klaatu, and this has been the GNU World Order. You can find me online at ogcastplanet.org/GNU World Order. You can find me by email by emailing me at klaatu@member.fsf.org. You can also find me on IRC on irc.freenode.net in the channel ogcastplanet or Slacker Media. You can also IM me, which I'm not really on IM all that often, but when I am, you can hit me up at notklaatu@jabber.org. Those are all the ways that I can think of to get a hold of me, so feel free to do so. So thanks for listening, and I will talk to you next week.